It's 1838 aboard a whaling ship 30 miles north of Cape Horn, Chile. Below deck in the stinking crew's quarters, grimy ruffians crowd around 15-year-old Roland H. Macy. Smoke and curses fill the air. Macy is the lowest swabby here. He's just 5'1", less than 120 pounds, and his fellow shipmates tease him endlessly. They call him Chum, as in bucket of chum. That's why he's decided to get a tattoo, to prove in blood that he's as tough as they are. Little R.H. Macy always has something to prove. He plants his right palm down on a wooden chest.
All right, go ahead. Do it. I'm ready. Chum won't be able to take it. I bet he'll cry like a little girl.
Macy glares back at his taunters. Some are relatives from his native Nantucket Island in Massachusetts.
Devil take the lot of you. I told you, I want the Red Star.
A sailor called Joe unwraps a filthy rag to reveal a set of sailmaker's needles.
Aye, aye, chum. Okay, hold them down, boys.
Joe bundles the needles together, dips them in a shallow bowl with red dye, and presses the contraption into the tender flesh between Roland's thumb and forefinger. Getting a tattoo in 1838, before the invention of electric needles, is a long and excruciating process. The veins on R.H.'s neck bulge, and he nearly bites his tongue off, desperate to hold in the cries of pain. But his palm stays planted.
What's the ink made of?
Joe lifts the bundle of needles from R.H.'s hand. Blood drips onto the wooden chest.
Some red leaf. It's called madder, in water.
Joe pauses and smiles.
Well, not water. Our water. It's better. Your water? What do you mean, your water?
Joe cocks his head, giving R.H. the side eye. The rest of the boys snicker and then break out in guffaws.
What do you think I mean?
That's when the realization sinks in. R.H. Macy will bear this five-pointed red North Star, the whaleman's symbol for the celestial body that guides them safely to port, forever. And this red badge of courage is made from a common weed and some Nantucket hooligan's piss. The Red Star tattoo does give R.H. some cred among his shipmates. But in the coming years, it will be worth so much more than that. As the logo for Macy's department store, it will grace bags and boxes of billions of dollars worth of goods. It will lure shoppers to one location in Manhattan, which for a time will be the biggest store in the world. But in the process, it will also act as a North Star for another ambitious trader. One day, that Red Star will draw the Gimbel brothers to Macy's doorstep, where they will ride along on Macy's brand like a great white shark in the wake of a whale. And when the time is right, the Gimbel brothers will show their teeth.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's vice chair and president, Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though many of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill talk about how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can check out this episode and a whole lot more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts.
From Wondery, I'm David Brown, and this is Business Wars. In our six-part series, Macy's vs. Gimbel's, we look at one of America's most bruising retail battles. It's hard to imagine in this age of online shopping and fast fashion that there was once a time when department stores were the most exciting places in the world, better than going to the circus. In fact, back in the heyday of department stores in the 1930s and 40s, you could go see a circus while you were there, or meet the famous aviator Amelia Earhart, or buy a dismantled 12th century monastery that once belonged to the media mogul William Randolph Hearst. These places were thrilling. Gimbel's and Macy's opened the way for the likes of Marshall Field's, Wanamaker's, Bloomingdale's, and even the 20th century big box stores like Walmart. This was before online shopping buried one department store chain after another. Before all that, Macy's and Gimbel's were retail wonders, founded by two very different men. One was an American-born Quaker, the other a German-Jewish immigrant. They both started retail dynasties grounded on different ideas of thrift, but both were aiming for the same target, the American middle-class consumer. This is Episode 1, The Frontiersman and the Whaler. It's May 1845, Boston, Massachusetts. Roland H. Macy sits at his desk in a dingy back room of his dry goods store. He picks up his fountain pen to tally the day's sales. R.H., as his family calls him, is now in his 20s, ruddy-cheeked and short, yet powerfully built. He comes from a long line of Nantucket whaling men and ran away to sea at 15, just around the same time Herman Melville was a deckhand researching his novel Moby Dick. The vivid red star moves as he writes. One whaling voyage was more than enough for him, so he set out to make his fortune in business. And now is the moment of his reckoning. R.H. begins to write. Receipts, 1 pair hose, 25 cents. 1 boy suspenders, 43 cents. 2 yards bonnet velvet, 96 cents. Expenses, to Mr. Jacob's delivery wagon, $3.95. 2 yards India silk, $1.28. 1 pair dimity cuff, 8 cents. 1 cotton knit rose notion, 12 cents. 3 lace doilies, 33 cents. 1 child undervest, 25 cents. As he goes down the pathetic list, his spirits sink. Macy slowly scrawls today's total, negative $3.46. For a few long moments, he stares down at this record of his own failure. Then he turns the page. In thick, black, flowing script, he writes one sentence in capital letters. I have worked 2 years for nothing. Then he adds 4 words. Damn. 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 Nearly 1,000 miles away from Boston, in Vincennes, Indiana, another merchant is facing a very different problem. It's a beautiful spring morning in 1845. Adam Gimbel stands outside his dry goods store. Something's not right. He's not happy with a painted sign on the front of his shop. It's the name, he thinks. It reads, Adam Gimbel, General Merchandise. Adam isn't aware of it, but he's talking to himself out loud. It's not very, what is the word? Impressing. Impressive. Adam is a Jewish immigrant from Bavaria. He often thinks in his native German when he's troubled. Otherwise, his self-taught English is rather solid. When he wants to learn something, he reaches out. He's learned Bible history from a wandering rabbi and math from a local Lutheran pastor, and a lot of other things by devouring the books in the pastor's library. Starting from nothing, Adam learned early to make the most of every opportunity. He worked as a ship deckhand to cover the cost of his journey to New Orleans. From there, he headed to Indiana, where he walked the banks of the Wabash River, nailing handbills on trees, advertising his merchandise, and selling dry goods out of an oilcloth sack on his back. He did this for years before opening a storefront. Now, in 1845, he works from behind a counter, running a thriving business. The walls of his dry goods store are crowded with signs that are neatly lettered and not too badly spelled. More to the point, they reflect his scruples, which are unusual for these parts. Signs that read, Gimbel's will conduct its business on a one-price policy, with fairness and equality to all patrons, whether they be residents of the city, plainsmen, traders, or Indians. That sentiment is a huge draw for Native Americans, who are forever getting fleeced by merchants who pay them less for their pelts than they pay white fur trappers. The natives travel miles out of their way to trade with Honest Adam in Vincennes. As for a one-price policy with clearly marked-as-advertised prices, no haggling and no bargaining, that's even rarer than treating Native Americans like equals. If Adam Gimbel says your buttons cost a halfpenny apiece, that's exactly what they cost, for you or anybody else who walks through the door. It feels quite modern and civilized to the good people of Vincennes, Indiana, who are accustomed to endless dickering over prices. And they're usually no match for the savvy frontier tradesmen. And once they're in the door, they're drawn in even more by Adam's innovative displays. He groups goods by category. Customers can find tailoring supplies, ribbons and pins all in one area, with neat wooden dividers or drawers, sometimes separate tables. This is state-of-the-art business model stuff. Most stores just arrange goods any which way, with darning wool next to the flour and hammers by the pickles. All in all, Adam Gimbel comes by his success the hardest way of all, by following his conscience, and above all, by being honest. Exaggeration, hyperbole, fanciful, poetic license, all of the stuff that makes for good advertising, goes completely against his ethos. That sense of honesty will become both his strength and his Achilles heel. So, standing in front of his store in 1845, Adam Gimbel thinks back to his time as a teenager in Bavaria, toiling in a baron's vineyards near Rheinfels. The baron's home was a 14th-century castle. He'd had enough of the hard work for little pay, the sickening smell of the baron's rotting grapes, and the stickiness he can't seem to wash off his fingers. He has a plan, and he shares it with his fellow workers.
I'm getting out of here. I'm going to America.
The very idea strikes them as absurd, and so they tease him.
You'll never work in a palace like this in America. They don't even have them in America. Then how are you going to get there, swim?
Gimbel signs up as a deckhand on a ship headed for America. That was some time ago. Now in Vincennes, his thoughts shift to the present moment. No palaces in America, huh? Then something occurs to him. He goes to the stables and returns with a brush and paint. Underneath the sign on his storefront that reads, Adam Gimbel, General Merchandise, he carefully adds, The Palace of Trade. He steps back to survey his work and smiles. Without knowing it, he's dubbed a former dentist office the first department store in the Midwest. In Boston, R.H. Macy is still trying to make peace with the fact that he lost the $500 he earned from a 4-year whaling voyage by gambling it on that needle and thread shop. He failed within a year. So he tries again with dry goods, but he fails at that as well. Macy is desperate. So he does what a lot of men are doing in 1849. R.H. and his younger brother Charles head to California to try their luck as 49ers. They know nothing about mining, nothing about the gold rush, and nothing about the West. R.H. figures his luck has got to change. And once again, he will miscalculate. Badly.
You know, Audible has a brand new collection of exclusive thrillers. Every move is made more exciting by captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. I just downloaded The Grand Opening by Carl Weber. It's a mystery about a family business in a small southern town, and there are secrets around every turn. You know, when I'm listening, the time just disappears, getting completely immersed in the story and the performances. And as an Audible member, you get to keep one title a month from their entire catalog, including bestsellers and new releases. So come on, listen along. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Head on over to audible.com/BW or just text BW to 500-500. That's audible.com/BW or text BW to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. As business owners and managers, you use software for your business every day. You use one piece of software to manage your customers, another to manage your employees, another to manage your finances, and the list goes on. You buy these pieces independently and hope they fit neatly together like a puzzle. And then you find out the hard way that they don't, and you end up with a mess at the heart of your business operations. Does any of this sound familiar? Well, fortunately, Zoho offers a solution to this chaos. It's called Zoho One. Zoho One is a suite of around 50 pre-integrated business applications that fit together beautifully. So instead of dealing with disparate software from multiple vendors with multiple contracts and price points, you deal with one vendor with all the pieces of the business software puzzle neatly put together, offered at a very attractive price. Now, if this sounds interesting to you, you got to check out Zoho One at zoho.one. That's Zoho.one. With Zoho, you're not just licensing apps. You're licensing peace of mind. ''50, Yuba City, California. R.H. Macy and his brother Charles are struggling to get a train of pack mules laden with mining supplies and other merchandise across the Feather River to their destination, Marysville, California. It's a settlement about 40 miles north of Sacramento and has become a way station for prospectors leaving San Francisco for the mines. It's early spring and the white-capped river runs neck-deep and bitterly cold. Like many sailors, R.H. never learned to swim properly. He's clutching the neck of the lead mule and trying not to pull them both under. Convinced he's going to drown, R.H. cries out to his brother.
Charlie! I don't think I'm gonna make it!
Charles tries to rally him.
Come on, you survived the South Pacific and you'll survive this! It'll be too embarrassing to go back to Nantucket and tell him a little river did you in.
One of the mules jerks his head up, smacking R.H. in the face. He curses the day they heard a hot tip. Marysville was surveying a town and luring lots of miners. The brothers jumped on the opportunity to get in early and open their mining supplies venture before the competition. They spent nearly all their cash buying merchandise and mules in San Francisco. And now, they could lose it all. And their lives. R.H. keeps repeating to himself,
if you just make it to the other side, you're going to be rich.
Miraculously, he and Charles survive. And only one mule drowns. Charles loses his left shoe. As they stand on the banks, heaving and dripping, they survey the scene in Marysville. Hundreds of men crowd the main street. Piles of freight boxes fill a muddy, vacant lot waiting to be unloaded. Tent after tent bears signs with crooked letters above the flaps that spell out, supplies for sale. And that's when it hits Charles and R.H. They aren't the first outfitters for the 49ers in Marysville. They aren't even among the first wave of merchants in Marysville. Not by a long shot. No, R.H. and Charles Macy are perhaps the last people on Earth to arrive in Marysville during the gold rush, looking to open a business. Just 3 months later, Macy and company is a bust. Charles falls in love with the West and stays in Marysville, where he finds work as a carpenter. R.H. arrives back in Boston, alone, broke, and mortified. His family takes pity on him and lends him enough money to open yet another dry goods venture in the small town of Haverhill, Massachusetts. This time, surprising even himself, he finally manages to turn a profit. He applies lessons learned in his previous failures and adopts a strict policy of only accepting payment in full in cash. At the time, nearly all stores operate on credit. To stay competitive, R.H. guarantees discounted prices.
He also advertises his Haverhill Cheap Store in a new and exciting way. And yes, cheap is in the name. The advertisements are elaborately worded, and there are multiple half or whole page ads in a single issue of the local Gazette. The ads lay out his cash-only low prices policy. He changes the copy every week to reflect new merchandise and to keep shoppers' attention. Other merchants just print two or three sentences with the wording the same week after week, month after month. ...1851, Haverhill, Massachusetts. A woman is shopping at the Haverhill Cheap Store for gingham cotton fabric to make a dress. She checks the price, 14.5 cents per yard. She's surprised because even though she'd seen the ad in the Haverhill Gazette for cloth at 14.5 cents, only the number 14 stuck in her head. She doesn't have any of these newfangled half pennies on hand at the store. But the clerk points out, depending how much yardage she needs, it can work out to an even number. And the competition is selling the same fabric for 15 cents a yard down the street. So she's saving a lot. Still, the customer is suspicious and challenges the clerk.
How can Mr. Macy sell this so cheaply? Is it stained?
No, it's in perfect condition. I think he just wants to keep us clerks on our toes by making us do all this math and making change for you folks.
Oh, poor you. I'm just hopeless at math. But this is lovely material, and the price is lovely as well. I'll take 7 yards.
The customers do exactly what Macy hoped they'd do. They notice the first number in the advertisement, but not the half penny that follows. Even if they're only saving a half penny, they feel like they're getting a bargain. And half pennies start to add up for a business. It's a forerunner of the 99-cent strategy that will one day appear everywhere. Finally, R.H. Macy is making money in the 1850s in New England. But in the Midwest, Adam Gimbel is doing even better. His Indiana store is thriving, and he's started a family that will eventually grow to 14 children, 7 of them sons. For the next 20 years, Adam Gimbel gives his sons the best education Indiana offers, and each boy apprentices at his side in his ever-expanding storefront. His surplus of sons will one day build a true palace of trade, an empire beyond Adam's wildest dreams. But Macy is not blessed with an abundance of heirs who can take over his business. He has one son, and that boy is more than a disappointment. He's a criminal. On the next episode, R.H. Macy sets up shop in New York City, but the Civil War threatens to destroy both the Macy family and the business. If they survive, they'll go up against a new generation of ambitious Gimbel brothers intent on expanding the company and eager to be America's first destination for the highest quality at the lowest prices. They won't put up with being in Macy's shadow for long. Hey, Prime members, you can binge every episode of Business Wars ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. From Wondery, this is Business Wars. We hope you enjoyed this episode. We should say something about the conversations in this episode. We can't know exactly what was said at the time, but this dialogue is based on our best research. I'm your host, David Brown. Barbara Bogay wrote this story. Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor. Sound design by Kyle Randall for Bay Area Sound. Our executive producers are Jenny Lauer-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Created by Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
I'm Trey Wingo.
And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass, busted draft pick, and game-changing play.
Or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow and listen to Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I mean, the possibilities are limitless, Kevin.
What if Portland drafted Michael Jordan?
What if the NBA never vetoed the Chris Paul trade to the Lakers?
That's a butterfly effect forever.